Greetings. This is podcast number 24 of Blast the Right. I'm Jack Clark from therationalradical.com, www.therationalradical.com. Today we're going to start off by discussing the nomination of Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court, focusing on his opposition to the one-person, one-vote doctrine. That doctrine may not be what you think it is, and it may be more important than you think it is. We're also going to have some listener email, some listener voicemail, and I'm going to introduce the Quick Blast segment. Let's get right into it. One of the themes running throughout my podcasts is that the right wing will do virtually anything to stay in power. They'll stop at nothing. This is the only way they can continue to effectuate their policies of unbridled greed. Since they're ruling in the interest of only a small percentage of the American people, the richest of the rich, staying in power isn't easy. Almost by definition, they have to thwart majority rule. How do they do so? In podcast 21, we spoke about Tom DeLay's illegal Texas redistricting, about GOP support for a Georgia poll tax, and about the Bush administration's evisceration of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division insofar as it relates to voting rights. Another way we've discussed in podcasts 13 and 17 is the massive GOP electronic voting machine fraud being perpetrated across the nation. In this podcast, I want to discuss an additional way the right-wing attempts to thwart majority rule. It's actually come up in the context of the nomination of Sam Alito to the Supreme Court, and for that reason, it's particularly relevant right now to discuss it. I'm talking about the one-person, one-vote doctrine that the Supreme Court enunciated over 40 years ago. Some of the mass media will quickly mention it, but they don't even explain what it means. What is one person, one vote? Does that mean that there's no double voting, that people can't go vote two times? Well, of course it's important that people not be allowed to vote two times, but that's not what one person, one vote has to do with. One person, one vote goes to the heart of democracy and therefore is, of course, the subject of right-winger disdain. I'll explain what one person, one vote is with a little bit of history. Before 1962, the year of the Supreme Court's Baker v. Carr decision, legislative districts in the states would have unequal numbers of people, not just a little bit, but wildly unequal. The large population district and the small population district would each elect one representative. For example, in Alabama, there was one county legislative district that included the city of Birmingham. It had 600,000 people. There was another county legislative district with 15,000 people, 1/40th the number of people. Yet both the Birmingham district with 600,000 and the other county with 15,000, they each got the same number of state senators, one. This type of setup would mean, for example, that in Maryland, a majority of the state Senate could be elected by only 14% of the voters. 25% of the voters could elect a majority in the state House of Delegates. The purpose of this, of course, was to increase the voting power of some communities and to decrease the voting power of other communities. The voting power of some communities would be increased at the expense of others. And of course, whose power would be increased and whose decreased? Usually it was the rural communities whose voting power would be vastly increased, at the expense of the large cities, whose voting power would be concomitantly decreased. And you know there's a racial component here, if it's not the actual reason itself for the very system. The districts with huge numbers of people, and hence diluted voting power, were often African American. Under this type of arrangement, the voting power of African Americans and other minorities, or for that matter, of liberals, or of conservatives, or of Caucasians, depending on who's in power, when liberals or conservatives or Caucasians reside in distinct geographic clusters, which they often do, the voting power of whatever group is out of office could be virtually permanently diluted to the point of total powerlessness. What could be more undemocratic? And therefore, what does the right wing love any more than this? Let's now get into what the Supreme Court did. In 1946, voters in Illinois challenged such a system of unequal voting districts. But the Supreme Court rejected the claim, saying it did not want to enter the, quote, political thicket, close quote. 16 years later, in 1962, Tennessee voters challenged their state's unequal legislative districts. This is the case of Baker v. Carr. The Warren Court reversed its earlier decision and said such a dilution of voting power could not be allowed to stand, and it ordered Tennessee's lines redrawn. 2 years later, the court in the Reynolds v. Sims decision set out what had to be done for legislative districts to be constitutional, and that is, quote, as nearly as is practicable, one man's vote, close quote, must, quote, be worth as much as another's, close quote. So that's where the one man, one vote standard arose, and it's now been modernized linguistically to one person, one vote. These Supreme Court decisions, according to a leading election law treatise, started a, quote, reapportion revolution, close quote. Parties in 34 states filed lawsuits challenging their legislative district lines. Those lawsuits didn't solve all the problems with partisan gerrymandering, but the system still became a lot fairer as a result. What did right-wingers think about this? Well, they didn't like it at all. Senator Richard Russell, for example, of Georgia, an ardent segregationist, had been bitterly critical of the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision, which declared unconstitutional the separate but equal doctrine. After Baker v. Carr was decided, Russell called it, quote, another major assault on our constitutional system, close quote. Indeed, segregationists like Richard Russell could see the writing on the wall. Baker v. Carr was part and parcel of, or at least supported, the national civil rights movement. As a state report put it, quote, when the courts began striking down redistricting plans for inequality of population, thus helping to provide urban areas with the political representation their populations warranted, Congress moved to the next step. In 1965, it enacted the Voting Rights Act to provide equality of opportunity for racial minorities to vote, close quote. And of course, right-wingers opposed the Voting Rights Act as well. Right-wingers saw Baker v. Carr, Reynolds v. Sims, and the Voting Rights Act as dire threats, because these legislative enactments and court decisions provided a means for the African American community to achieve the voting power its numbers warranted. That would be democratic. But the heck with democracy if it threatens right-wing power. Sound familiar? Now, before someone writes in and says, wait a second, Richard Russell was a Democrat, let me repeat something I've said a couple of times. Back in those days, the primary split that I'm concerned about wasn't Democrat-Republican, but rather liberal-conservative, or put another way, progressive right-winger. At that time, Republicans still had a fairly alive liberal wing, and Democrats definitely had a very alive and powerful reactionary racist wing. In other words, the right wing. So don't let a right winger say that, well, Democrats in the South supported that unequal districting back then, so they can't complain about it now. No, it's not about Republicans versus Democrats. It's about progressives versus right wingers. And progressives back then supported one person, one vote, opposed unequal districting, and they still do now. And right wingers back then opposed one person, one vote, and supported unequal districting. And in fact, some of them still do now. Remember Robert Bork, who was rejected for the Supreme Court? During his confirmation hearings in 1987, he said, quote, one man, one vote does not come out of anything in the Constitution, close quote. As Adam Cohn put it in a New York Times op-ed recently, quote, there is a strong strand of anti-democratic thinking among far-right lawyers. Jay Bybee, who helped develop the Bush administration's pro-torture policy and is now a federal judge, has criticized the 17th Amendment, which requires that United States senators be elected by the people instead of by state legislatures, as they once were. Close quote. Adam Cohn also points out that just recently, an American Enterprise Institute scholar was writing in the far-right Washington Times defending Judge Alito, and that scholar suggested that Baker v. Carr was wrong. Which brings us to Samuel Alito. Back when he was a Princeton undergraduate, he opposed the Baker v. Carr and Reynolds v. Sims Supreme Court decisions. Then when he was 35 years old, he was applying for a job in the Reagan Justice Department. In his application, he said one of the things that had attracted him to constitutional law as a college student was his disagreement with the Warren Court decisions about reapportionment. Does he still have the same position? If so, when he got on the Supreme Court, the results could be a nightmare. Adam Cohn writes, quote, if Judge Alito was able to forge a conservative Supreme Court majority to overturn the reapportionment cases, the results would be disastrous. The next Tom DeLay-style redistricting in Texas could conceivably stuff most of the state's Democratic voters into two or three multi-million person congressional districts, while reserving the state's remaining 30 or so seats for Republicans. Small claques could control entire state governments, as they did until 1962, close quote. And just as how right-wingers would like it to be again. And you know that Tom DeLay, even if he has to direct things from his corruption conviction jail cell, would do so in a heartbeat if he could. Now, do right-wingers oppose these reapportionment cases because of some constitutional principle dear to their hearts? No, I say no. The position they adopt because it's anti-democratic, anti-majority rule, and anti-African-American. It's of a piece with everything that they espouse. Right-wingers just take whatever principle will support the conclusion they want and go with it. It's like with deferring to the states when the Constitution doesn't explicitly give the federal government a certain power. Right-wingers rant and rave about this all the time. But when taking the opposite position was necessary for them to remain in power, well then, the opposite position they took. I'm referring, of course, to Bush v. Gore in 2000, when the right-wingers on the Supreme Court all of a sudden became very expansive in their understanding of the powers of the federal government and felt that the federal government had the power to order a state government, that of Florida, to stop counting the 2000 presidential election ballots. Think about it for a minute. If African Americans were the majority and tried to pull off one of these unequal election district schemes, you can bet your bottom dollar that right-wingers, amplified a thousandfold by their main propaganda organ, Fox News, would be screaming bloody murder that one person, one vote was the primary rule of constitutional jurisprudence, more important than the Magna Carta, even that it was a sacred part of our Judeo-Christian tradition, and that those who don't support one person, one vote are part of the war against Christianity. Getting back to Judge Alito, his opposition to one person, one vote is consistent with other anti-democratic views that he's espoused over the years. He was a member of an ultra-conservative group called Concerned Alumni of Princeton. This fine group of Princeton graduates opposed co-education and affirmative action. Now, shades of John Roberts with the Federalist Society, Alito has said he doesn't recall being a member of that group. Funny how that selective memory thing works, isn't it? On Alito overall, how serious a threat is Alito? Well, one senator, Joseph Biden, seemed to be taking him very seriously. Biden said, quote, "If he really believes that reapportionment is a questionable decision, that is, the idea of Baker v. Carr, one man, one vote, then clearly, you'll find a lot of people, including me, willing to do whatever they can to keep him off the court. That would include a filibuster if need be." Close quote. If you don't think Alito's views on these various issues would justify a filibuster, please think again. As Adam Cohn put it, Baker v. Carr and Reynolds v. Sims were decided, quote, "to ensure that the democratic process is not rigged to thwart the will of the majority." Even if Judge Alito has changed his position on the reapportionment cases, the fact that he was drawn to constitutional law because of his opposition to those rulings raises serious questions about his views on democracy and equality, close quote. Even a reporter, Jess Braven, for the right-wing Wall Street Journal recently wrote, quote, "Judge Alito will most likely insist at his hearings that he feels bound by Baker v. Carr and Reynolds v. Sims. Even if he can be trusted, it will say a great deal about him if he supports one person, one vote, only because he believes that respect for precedent, or confirmation politics, requires it. Most Americans know, based on their innate sense of justice and the Constitution, why the pre-1960s way of electing legislators was not acceptable then and is not now." Close quote. In other words, regardless of what a nominee says at a hearing, even if he accepts Baker v. Carr, we know where his predilections lie, where his sympathies lie. And the next time a question of fundamental fairness arises, a question that democratic rule itself may hinge upon, we can expect such nominee to rule as a member of the Supreme Court the wrong way, the right-winger way.
No justice, no peace. What matters, hell, and
I receive a lot of great listener email, much of it well written, making very, very good cogent points. I'm going to start reading more of it in the podcast. And I'll start right now with one such email. The theme of the main podcast segment today was the undemocratic predilections of the right wing. As I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, one of the ways that manifests itself is in the GOP's massive electronic voting machine fraud that's been perpetrated across the country. So I like what a listener, Arlene, wrote in part, quote, "Never do a show, Jack, that does not cover these two points. One, the system being set up for us to vote with is easy to corrupt massively and instantly, and is not transparent. Because voting is the cherished foundation of democracy, we need to fight the machines and go to paper. It is the only safe way to conduct an election. Two, we have the opportunity in 2006 to vote for accountability in the House, since every single House member is up for re-election. It must be a landslide for Democrats. Landslides are much harder to steal. Point up that a Democratic majority means a Democratic Judiciary Committee, where impeachment begins. Repeat these two ideas. They are important enough to justify doing that." Close quote. Well, I just did, at least this podcast.
To kind of catapult the propaganda. In my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again to kind of catapult the propaganda. Catapult the propaganda.
I know a lot of my segments are fairly long, and they contain a lot of facts and a lot of principles that all have to be woven together to make the point. Many times if you're talking with a right winger, you don't have time to get into all that. So I'm going to now institute a segment that will recur, and I call it the Quick Blast. It'll be short, with a salient fact or two that you can throw at a right winger and that they won't have an answer to. This Quick Blast will be about President Bush's recently boasting that in 2005 the economy added about 2 million jobs. If a right-winger tells you that, you throw back at him the fact that, at this point in the last recovery, the yearly job gain total was 3.5 million. We're almost 50% less than where we should be. And not only are there not enough jobs, but the jobs that are being created have too many lousy jobs among them. Average hourly wages and weekly salaries have been flat or falling for the past 2 years after inflation is factored in. There's been a decline in earning power, but Americans have gone on a borrowing binge, and that has masked the decline in earning power. The reality is, if you don't create good jobs and rising wages, widespread prosperity will not occur. It'll be concentrated. And that's what's happened now. The benefits of our economic growth have become increasingly concentrated at the top of the income scale. And that's illustrated by the holiday shopping season results. Lower and middle income shoppers largely go to places like Walmart, Sears, and Kohl's. These stores all had disappointing results. Chains at the higher end, like Neiman Marcus and Nordstrom, they thrived. 2 million jobs in 2005? That's nothing to brag about, George. Good news for those of you who like to call in with comments. I've gotten Skype working again. I'll include details at the end of the podcast how you can call in. Right now, I want to play two quick messages I received quite some time ago. I was just recently able to get them to play properly. The first one is kind of touching, and the second one, well, is somewhat amusing. Here's the first one.
Hello, Mr. Jack Clark. My name is Mario. I live in Tucson, Arizona. I just got a buddy of mine was sending me through some websites, and I wound up with yours, and I think you're doing a great job. I saw your thing. I wanted to praise you did. I wish, you know, I hope real success for you. You need to blow up, you know, and I honor everything you say on your end. I can sit here with my wife and just listen, and you're on the button, buddy. So keep up the good work.
I loved Mario's sort of stream of consciousness, how he said he could sit there with his wife and just listen. And I liked the ending expression he used, right on the button. I may be wrong, but that sounds to me like an expression used more in the 20s than now. Maybe Mario, who sounds kind of like a young guy, he may have an elderly relative around who he picked that expression up from. Now, here's the second voicemail. I assure you this is a real message I received. Apparently this caller was on my podcast homepage and called in. He must have heard the original voicemail greeting, which was a woman with an English accent.
I figured it's some foreigner like you doing this. What trash this is. I have never seen so much trash in my life as I just read on this stupid thing on the computer. The Rational Radical. What a bunch of trash. All you foreigners, go to hell home.
You know, sometimes I use that right-winger voice.
No, I'm a right-winger.
Some of you like it and some don't. I got an idea. Maybe I could hire the guy who called in with this message. He could be my right-winger voice. And no one could complain because it's a real person and he sounds like a right-winger. Well, that'll about wrap it up for today. If you liked what you heard, please tell a friend about Blast the Right. If they don't know about podcasting, turn them on to that as well. Or they can just go to my podcast homepage and sign up for an email notification of each new podcast by using the FeedBlitz sign-up box. You know, Blast the Right has about 1,300 subscribers now. Boy, would I be happy if each one of you just got one more person to sign up. Along those lines, if you'd like to help out Blast the Right in another way, you can go to podcastalley.com, search for the Blast the Right podcast page, and click vote. Okay, good news. I got the Skype working again. So anyone who wants to can call in and leave a message for me to play on the podcast. If you're on Skype, my name is Jack from Blast the Right. If you're not on Skype, you can call in from any phone. Just call 310-933-5891, 310-933-5891, and leave a message. Music credits. We opened with L.A. Nightmare by 22 Caliber. They're at music.podshow.com. Then we heard a bit of No Justice, No Peace by Wachiavelli. They're at www.wachiavelli.com. WACKIAVELLI.com. Next was Catapult the Propaganda by Nise Music, NISE Music.com. The last bumper music was Not the One Blues by Burnshee Thornside. He's at magnatune.com, magnatune.com. We'll close out the podcast with a little bit of Taking My Country Back by Honky Tonkers for Truth. The link to that song, as well as links to all the music played on Blast the Right, can be found on my music resources page, which is linked to off the main podcast homepage. Also, Links to all the quotes and statistics used on the Blast the Right podcast can be found on my data resources page, also linked to off the main podcast homepage. If you'd like to write into me, my email address is rational@adelphia.net. I'd love to hear from you. So, until next time, I'll sign off and say I love you all, including all you right-wing pieces of crap.
Now you don't know my name, but you know who I am. I'm your everyday work hard, play hard, raise kids and pray hard, common man. And Lord knows I love this land. That's why I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you. Don't